carry no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 4 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes on The Commentist Network, and that's at thecommentist.com. And you can reach us by emailing us at thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. And brand new for this episode, you can now follow us on Instagram, predictably at thebeardedvegans. And that's going to be the only social media outlet that we're going to have, I think, because we don't really care.
And we have very busy lives. but we care about you.
We don't care to maintain a Twitter and a Facebook. We care very deeply about this podcast and the issues that we talk about.
Yes. So in today's episode, we will be doing a brief follow-up on last week's review of Unity, discussing vegan news, and moving on into our topic of the week, which is, should vegans support Ben & Jerry's? And then we'll be concluding with an interview with Tony Okamoto, the founder of Plant-Based on a Budget.
This is the first time where we're releasing a podcast in a timely fashion. We released the first three all in one big bunch. So we wanted to, you know, jump into some vegan news and some timely issues. But before we did that, we wanted to jump back quickly to last week's episode where we did a review of Unity, which is the new film by Earthlings director Sean Monson.
And if you haven't listened to that that episode, I would suggest listening to it because I think it was a pretty entertaining episode. But just to spoil it, if you haven't listened to it, we were not very fond of the movie, so we gave it a pretty scathing review.
Yeah, and I think that's probably putting it lightly. I think, I don't know about you, but in the time that my opinion has had to grow and, you know, feed on itself since that review, I have certainly grown to dislike the film even more. What's your experience?
I've received multiple texts from Andy that have just said lines like, I hate the movie even more, and things like that. So I don't think I feel that strongly about it, but I didn't think about it and then say like, oh, we made some good points or something like that. I thought about it and been like, still doesn't make any sense to me. So I feel pretty much the same as when I saw it. I also haven't. I feel like Andy's been going on a rampage, like commenting on people's Facebook and stuff like that. So maybe there are new things that you've thought about, and I'm just kind of like, I don't really care to think about this movie much anymore.
Fair enough. I think if I could just erase it from my brain and forget about it, I would. The reason why I thought it was, you know, maybe important to bring it up again in this episode. Yeah. Hopefully we can keep it short, but you know, when we record the podcast, we watched the film, didn't talk to each other, drove immediately to the Bearded Vegans headquarters, aka Paul's house, and recorded the podcast. So we didn't really get a chance to take in public opinion, see what other people were thinking about it before we talked about it. And since then, you know, of course it was all, you know, shown one night at one time, so everyone's talking about it at the same time. And you know, I was curious to see what people were saying about it. And I was worried that a lot of people would be afraid to criticize it because it is this, you know, film from a monumental director who has contributed a huge, you know, amount to this movement. And that, you know, I did see criticism of the film, but I also saw a lot of people very hesitantly criticizing the film, and then I would kind of poke and prod a little bit and be like, I actually hated it and thought it was a mess. And then they're like, you're right, I just didn't want to say anything bad about the film. So I just think it's important to say that if you don't like something in this movement, something that's representing veganism, like, don't be afraid to speak up about it. I've seen several animal rights advocates that are just, regardless of any criticism levied against them, saying, we must support this film. It's our imperative to promote this film because it has a vegan message. And I think we need to reject that type of thinking, because we're not going to progress if we just sort of blindly accept everything that's coming at us. We're at a point now where it's like, we got a ton of different vegan cheeses, a ton of different vegan restaurants. And like, we don't have to just promote something just because it's kind of vegan. Like if vegan cheese sucks, say that it sucks. Like, don't be afraid to do that. So that's just my little mini rant on the follow-up to Unity.
Yeah. And I think that's important for the movement, because we need to self-assess. We need to be critical of ourselves in order to promote veganism the best that we can. And I think this applies to the issue of veganism, like vegan outreach, but also any, really any issue, or anything in life. Don't like put people on, don't put people or an idea or a project on a pedestal, because then you become afraid to criticize it, even if it deserves to be criticized. So, that was my little rant that I had there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I hope we can do an episode on the future on hero worship and the pitfalls and perils of that, and of putting certain people up on a platform and then not, you know, listening to when maybe they've done something problematic or, you know, an accusation against them, whatever it might be. So hopefully we'll talk about that in a future episode.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so let's get that off the table. I promise we won't talk about it again until the next time that we do. But yeah, like I said, we are now releasing episodes on a weekly basis, fingers crossed. And, you know, that gives us the opportunity to talk about current news that's coming out. So this is going to be our first vegan news section. And there's been a couple of different stories that have come out, not necessarily specifically related, but they all kind of talk about the issue of animals in captivity. So the first thing I just wanted to bring up, this actually is a story that broke earlier today, and you can find the full story on greenisthenewred.com, but two animal activists are facing up to 6 months in prison for protesting peacefully on a sidewalk. The activists are Jeremy Beckham and Lexi Levitt. And they were visited by detectives and served court orders for protesting without a permit. And apparently in Salt Lake City, where it was, you're supposed to fill out a permit of intent to protest and pay $50. And despite all their efforts to legally protest, they still got slapped with that. And they were outside of the Lagoon Amusement Park, and they were standing across the street. And they were on public land, and they knew it was public land because they actually went down to the town hall and like got the maps to like make sure it was public land that it was, you know, safe to protest on. And they didn't use megaphones. They didn't use any amplification. They made all these efforts to make sure that they were protesting legally, stuff that many activists would not do, and probably for good reason. So, you know, I think when we think about this issue, to me, what it says is that, well, Lagoon Amusement Park is getting desperate, but I think that in general, the activists are quite saying that there's a bit of a blackfish effect that's happening, both for the orcas at SeaWorld, of course, but also for, you know, all animals in captivity. It's starting to get people questioning it. You know, maybe not as much as we'd like. People still do focus on specific animals, orcas, elephants.
Yeah, I don't see it as much in zoos.
Yeah. But I think that it is starting to get people open up to the idea. And so, you know, it's, to me, that says that we're winning, or we're on our path to winning, because it's no longer something that the amusement parks are just like laughing at. They're taking that threat very seriously, which sort of leads into the next little piece of news. This is actually a couple weeks old, but because, you know, I brought up blackfish, it was posted that SeaWorld's profits have dropped 84%. Since blackfish has come out.
That's awesome. That's huge.
Yeah, that is not a small number at all. That is huge. And that's, you know, comparing this quarter to the quarter last year. So it's not like the overall thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's got to sting. That's really got to hurt. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, do we think that the end of animal captivity is near? Obviously, there's a long way to go, but we're starting to see these huge gains being made.
Yeah.
And even if people are only protesting SeaWorld because of the orcas, hopefully that's something that will get people, you know, thinking twice before they enter into an animal entertainment industry.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that people are going to start making those connections, even if it might take them a little longer. But I'm definitely seeing like a lot of my vegan friends on Instagram or Facebook, just like with the Cecil the Lion thing, there are people saying like, oh, you're against SeaWorld, well, why aren't you against this captive animal in a zoo? And even though I'm friends with mostly vegans on these social media networks, I think non-vegans are seeing it too, and they can only resist it for so long.
The charms of anti-captivity protesting. Yeah, I think that's a really important point, is that it can be used as an entryway to get people to care about these issues, just like we talked about with Seuss of the Lion, is that, you know, even the instinct to just shake people and be like, why do you care so much about this one lion when there's like 7 billion chickens that are dying way worse deaths, you know, every year, you know, but really it's just about like leveraging that, use it as a platform to start talking about animal issues and hopefully get people on board, even if it's not, you got to go vegan right now, but just be like, hey, so you care about that animal. Why do you care about that animal? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, hopefully that can all point towards really good things for helping to get people over to, you know, considering veganism.
Yeah.
And the last piece of news, something that I found incredibly interesting, this just came out a few days ago. There's an article in Science Magazine, sciencemag.org, and the title of the article is, Has U.S. Biomedical Research on Chimpanzees Come to an End? And so, of course, that's really intriguing, and you dive into the article and you learn that in order for any lab to test on chimpanzees, to do an invasive test where, you know, you're vivisecting or operating on them, you have to apply for a permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And currently, there are zero applications for chimpanzee testing. So that's really interesting. And Stephen Ross, who is the director of the Lester E. Fisher Center for the Study and Conservation of Apes at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, Illinois. It's a long title. is quoted as saying, this is the beginning of the end of invasive chimpanzee research. Scientists have seen the writing on the wall. So, I don't know about you, that's really exciting to me.
Yeah. Does the article make it seem like they're ending it because they're like, oh, wow, this is really messed up? Or is it like some other reason, like it's they're not accessible anymore or something like that?
Oh, that's a good question. There's actually a couple aspects of it that are causing that to happen. So, the first thing is that in 2013, this is sort of the start of the snowball effect of major change happening, and that is the National Institute of Health announced that they would phase out most forms of chimpanzee testing. And I guess the caveat to that is if it's something that is used to help preserve the species, so I don't know if the disease specific to that animal or whatever, you know, along those lines, that is the only case in which the testing would be permissible. Mm-hmm. And then in June of this year, the National Fish and Wildlife listed that chimpanzees would be classified as endangered species, and that includes all of the 700 that are currently being used for testing in labs. And the deadline for that is September 14th, so it's coming up very soon. Mm-hmm. And any tests that were started before then have to end on the 14th. So
cool.
So there's all of that, but most interestingly, let's see here. Robert Lanford, who is the current director of the Southwest National Primate Research Center in San Antonio, Texas, he is quoted in the article, and this is, I think, why it's most important to bring this up. Lanford says he's not surprised that other labs have also not applied for permits. Any applications, he says, are likely to attract the attention of animal advocates, and it's not clear whether the Fish and Wildlife Service would grant the permit. Public opinion is currently heavily influencing this process, he says. Nobody wants to be the first test case.
That's amazing, because that's basically saying, like, what animal advocates and protesters are doing is actually working, and it's making a huge difference.
Absolutely.
That's really cool.
So I think, you know, I wanted to get this out because last week's review was a lot of fun, but a little negative. So I want to start this off with like good news. And I think all of those articles, obviously not great that these two activists are facing up to 6 months in prison for their protesting. Mm-hmm. But all of it just points towards the fact that public opinion is changing. Animal advocates are having an effect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not the sweeping reform for every animal ever that we want, of course, but it's such a huge step acknowledging, you know, the life of these chimpanzees. It's such a cool thing. And the fact that the people that are doing the testing are acknowledging that animal advocates are having a huge impact, like, yeah, right on. So, yeah, congratulations to everyone that's been working on those campaigns.
Yeah.
It's such a cool thing. So,
yeah, definitely. And I felt like this kind of leads us into our topic of the week, because we were just kind of saying how it seems like slow, if albeit slow, changes are starting to happen. And one of these changes that we found out about pretty recently was that Ben & Jerry's is going to release some vegan flavored ice creams. And the reason that I wanted to talk about this was because it seems like, at least from social media, it seems like people are kind of split as to whether or not to support Ben & Jerry's, because on one hand, it's awesome they're making a vegan ice cream that vegans can eat, and it'll be, I'm sure it'll be delicious because it's Ben & Jerry's. But on the other hand, that'll be a fraction of the total revenue that Ben & Jerry's is taking in, the majority of which coming from actual dairy ice cream. So, Andy, I just want to know what your initial, because I have opinions on this. What are your initial thoughts about Ben & Jerry's?
Well, that's a big question. I actually, for the years that I remember, at least, grew up in Williston, Vermont, right next to Burlington, Vermont. Ben & Jerry's is a staple of Vermont, of course. I've taken the factory tour many, many times to get the free samples. And Ben & Jerry have actually came to my school, you know, first through fourth grade, somewhere around there, and they would scoop ice cream for the kids. So I actually have, like, a very intimate relationship with Ben & Jerry's. I love Ben & Jerry's, and not as a vegan, of course, but, you know, whenever I see vegan ice cream companies coming out with new flavors, I'm just like, oh, chocolate peanut butter again, cookie dough again, mint chocolate, oh, cool. You know, and I'm like, why can't we get fish food? Why can't we get Chubby Hubby? Why isn't there some ice cream company stepping up to the plate and making these, like, bizarre, amazing flavors like Ben & Jerry's does?
Well, we did get the cashew snickerdoodle, which was delicious.
If you're listening to this and you haven't tried the So Delicious cashew ice cream, like, press pause or pop in the earbuds and, like, go find it immediately, because it's the best ever.
Yeah, it's very good.
But yeah, so to answer your question, I'm a fan of Ben & Jerry's in general, or was, obviously. I don't like their current source of ice cream, the dairy and all that. But yeah, I do like Ben & Jerry's as a company. I like that they at least appear to be more socially minded, and they, you know, take on social issues, and, like, sometimes at least.
Yeah.
And they even took on climate change with a flavor. I forget exactly what the flavor was. It was, of course, very bizarre that they chose to take on climate change with a dairy-based ice cream.
So my next question, are you putting Ben & Jerry's on a pedestal?
No hero worship from me.
I have a similar opinion with Andy that I'm going to buy this Ben & Jerry's ice cream when it does come out, which I believe is going to be sometime in 2016. Whoa,
I didn't say I would buy it when it came out.
What? You've just been saying how great they were this whole time. So you are not going to support it.
No, I will buy it.
Okay. All right. But I will support it, and the thing is that not only will I get it because it's something that I can eat, I want to get it specifically because right now it's Ben & Jerry's is only going to have a few flavors of dairy-free ice cream. And my reasoning is, and this comes up, I've seen it come up before, for instance, when Silk has those holiday flavors of a soy milk, and a lot of people are against them because, if I'm not mistaken, Silk, the company that owns Silk, is, like, one of the largest dairy companies in the world.
Well, they were owned by White Wave or Dean Foods, or one of them's a subsidiary of the other. But they recently, within the last, like, year or two, announced that they've become their own company again. So, okay. So I guess the parent company isn't a dairy company, but
regardless, I would still support it, and my reason is that if we're talking about Ben & Jerry's, or we're talking about, like, one of the larger milk corporations in the world, I don't think that not supporting their vegan options is going to, like, make their company collapse. Like, Ben & Jerry's is really popular, probably not as popular as this, what was it, the
Dean Foods and White Wave.
So it's like, these are, especially that one, they're, like, giant corporations, and I feel like unless you can get everyone, which is the ideal, to get everyone to stop drinking their milk, they're not going to close that company. So my thought is that if we can show them that more people have interest in their dairy-free options, then they're going to put more of their resources into that and say it's less, because I mean at the end of the day they're all about money, and they're going to say, oh, it's more, it's better for us to make this soy milk than to make regular milk. And to me that applies to a lot of things. Obviously if a company, there are like different circumstances, I would take everything case by case, but that's kind of like my general rule, unless I find out something else about a company, is that even if they have, if they're a part of a parent company or something like that that makes non-vegan foods, if they're a giant company, they're not going to get shut down by us not eating their vegan options. And I would rather have them see that it's more beneficial for them to make more vegan options and less non-vegan options.
Yeah, I do think that for me, it's not necessarily that not supporting them won't shut them down, because, you know, that's a common thing that's levied against vegans, which is, well, one person's not going to make a difference. If I go vegan, it's not going to shut down the whole system. So I don't necessarily think that's the best reason to say that you would support the vegan mm-hmm. options. But I do think that exactly what you said, support the vegan options, because it shows that there is a market for that. And, you know, that's something that I see in the vegan community, is sort of that debate between, should you go to a non-vegan restaurant that has vegan options? And, you know, a lot of people, that's not really even a question for them, because they don't have an all-vegan mm-hmm. restaurant in their town. But, you know, it's difficult. I think that for me, it almost feels kind of elitist, because I feel, you know, a lot of people that say that are like in San Diego, San Francisco, LA, mm-hmm. where you have like a ton of vegan options. And, you know, for the average person, that's not necessarily the case. And maybe they have the vegetarian or the vegan place in town. But, you know, it's like we want veganism to be accessible to the masses. And if you're trying to sell someone on veganism and you're like, oh, by the way, you can only go to this one restaurant for the rest of your life until someone else opens up another restaurant, or you got to drive 40 miles to the next one.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's not going to sell anyone on it. And obviously people should care because of the animals, but you know, the easier that you make it for someone to be vegan, the more likely they're going to be vegan. Because as we all know, when we start out, it seems really hard. It seems like this giant wall that you're never going to get over mm-hmm. until you start doing it and realize it's easy. And that brings it right back to Ben and Jerry's. The reason that I would support it is because, you know, one of the biggest issues when I talk to college students about going vegan is like, well, what am I going to eat? And so the fact that I can say, oh, you can go get a tofu sofrito burrito at Chipotle mm-hmm. and get a veggie sub at Subway and get the, you know, replace the meat with beans at Taco Bell, then all of a sudden they go, oh, like that's a lot more accessible than I thought it was. And the fact that you can be like, hey, when you go out for ice cream with your friends, you go to Ben and Jerry's, you don't just have to get the sorbet, you can go get this wild vegan fish food or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will backtrack and say that I do think that vegans, just by not consuming, for instance, dairy products or meat products, I do think that they are having an effect on these companies. I think there's tons of data that shows that like this consumption is going down. I just think that it would be, I don't know how to say this, it would be more, it's more likely that a company like that will switch what they sell than just say like, then just like go down on a like the Titanic of milk and just be sinking, and just the captain of the ship, and just like, why wouldn't they say like, oh wait, I can still make tons of money by making this other product.
The band is playing on as they drown in a sea of milk.
And yeah, especially like you brought up the sofritas at Chipotle. And it's like, I think it's much more likely that we would eventually, not in the next year probably, but we would eventually see Chipotle replace, like give up their meat just for the sofritas and maybe a couple other options, than a Chipotle just completely going out of business. So, and it's like, I would rather have a Chipotle with all these options than no Chipotle at all, because I freaking love Chipotle.
It's, you know, supply and demand is a real thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where we got to be looking at. And the more accessible, I don't think that vegan consumerism is going to you know, be the revolution that we need, but I also don't think that it's a bad thing, and I think that the easier that we make it for people, the better. Something that I'll probably end up talking about on this show a lot is that I, you know, toured around extensively on the 10 Billion Lives tour, where we show people a 4-minute video about the treatment of animals on farms and college campuses, and we talked about going vegan afterwards, and we did a stretch that everyone was a little scared of in Mississippi and Alabama, and as far as I know, there's not a single all-vegan restaurant in those states, and I think maybe they have a vegetarian restaurant somewhere. We didn't encounter one. And so it's like, you're talking to people in those towns, and it's like, if you're saying you should only support this all vegan place, they're like, fuck that. Like, I'm not, you know, why would they want to do that?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe once they start to really get into the ethics of it, they'll be like, maybe it is worth it. I don't want to go give my money to a place that also serves dead animals or animal secretions. But at that very beginning negotiation phase where you're like, hey, let's try vegan a couple days a week, see how you feel about it. It's like, you know, you're not going to sell anyone on it if you're saying you shouldn't. And I was grateful for the fact that we could find Chipotle, or that they have Mellow Mushrooms, a pizza chain in that region, and they carry Daiya cheese for their pizzas. And we found one that had like marinated tempeh. They had a, you know, it That's wasn't cool. like vegan faux meats or anything like that, but it was like, you get tofu on your pizza. And so it's like the fact that like a pizza place in college towns are offering that, that's awesome. And I would be happy to support that company and point every single college party in their direction, be like, hey, just ask for the Daiya cheese and you're good to go.
Yeah. And if it's like, if it's not Chipotle or not, if it's not a food chain, if it's like something that's like it's mom and pop restaurant. Is that a term?
Sure.
Can you refer to restaurants as mom and pop? If it's just like a locally, there we go. If it's a locally owned restaurant.
By a mom and pop?
Yes.
single mom restaurant.
Like if it's something like that, it's like, if they did serve, if we're talking about this where they have some vegan options, it's like, that would make me want to support that more, to again show them that hopefully eventually they'll be able to just they'll be able to succeed in their business just on vegan options. But it's like, I don't want to see some, like, I don't want to see a mom and pop like suffer, you know. We got to worry about our non-human animals too. So
our moms and pops.
Our moms and pops, yeah. And so the last thing I wanted to bring up, which is something very related but with a slightly different twist, is how do you feel about when Daiya came out with that like recipe book about how to use their cheese with like meat products? Because that's almost like the opposite. What we were talking about before is non-vegan businesses that come out with vegan options. This is like, as far as I know, well, I only use Daiya for the cheese and their other vegan products, so who knows if they make non-vegan stuff, but it's a vegan company that is now saying like, oh, hey, you can use this with meat too. And that I feel like is kind of different. So what did you think about that?
Yeah, I feel conflicted on that. It feels like a really weird and maybe almost desperate move. Like, it almost feels like them saying, like, we can't survive without promoting meat. And, you know, I know they kind of claim, like, well, we're not a vegan company. And, like, they're a vegan company. They sell vegan stuff. As far as I know, they don't make anything that is not vegan. I didn't think so. And they're separate, you know, they're independently owned. They're not owned by anyone else, as far as I know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Send an email to the corrections department. So yeah, I mean, I for some reason that does instill some like rage inside of me that is different than when, you know, because it's like when Ben and Jerry says, hey, we're going to try out this coconut milk ice cream or something. It's like, oh, great. We're making some progress and we're making veganism more accessible. And for Daiya to go, hey, oh, you can have these chicken nachos with our cheese. That's a step backwards. And, you know, they don't need to be out there promoting tofurkey and cheese sandwiches or something, but there's ways for them to promote their product that doesn't involve, you know, throwing animal products into the menu mix. And I know they say a lot of recipes they post are user submitted. So it's like, obviously there's people that are just lactose intolerant and like their cheese because of that. But yeah, it feels like a really bizarre move on their part.
Yeah, and like I'm not lactose intolerant, but I would feel like if I was lactose intolerant, but I still ate meat, I would be like, oh, Daiya's vegan, I can have it then. I don't think I'd be like, oh, it's vegan, I'm not going to eat it because I also eat meat. It's like if you're lactose intolerant, but you don't care anything about animals, you're just going to be like, okay, this doesn't have milk, I'm going to use this product, I'm going to put it on chicken.
It's like, I don't know how to use this without a recipe.
Yeah. So because I feel like that must have been the angle that they were going for, was, oh, hey, lactose intolerant people that eat meat can eat Daya too. But it's like, why wouldn't they already know that they can eat that? I don't know. It's that like rubbed me the wrong way a little bit, especially because at least in Connecticut and in the Northeast, it seems like Daya is like the supreme overlord of vegan cheeses. unless they're like, I don't know, it doesn't seem like they're going away anytime soon, especially because their cheesecake seems to be pretty successful. And their cheese is just, it's like you said, that fast food pizza chain uses their cheese. It seems like they're, I don't know, I would think that they're, I don't know, this is a weird thing to say, but I would think that they're successful enough as it is to not have to do that. But I mean, maybe the president of Daya or the creator of Daya is just lactose intolerant. Dictator of Daya is just lactose intolerant. And I don't know what their philosophies are. Maybe they don't care about animals at all. It could be, but
yeah, it feels like they were start, and this is total speculation, but it feels like they were started by vegans and then they like brought on board some marketing people that were not vegan, and they're like, we got to open this up to a bigger audience. But yeah, they do seem to be the supreme cheese overlords, vegan cheese overlords at least, and they seem very secure in their position. I know when they were first coming out, obviously it was quote unquote a game changer, which is a very way overused phrase, but they might even be close to being that because they were kind of the first cheese that was like, oh my god, like I could make a quesadilla and give it to a non-vegan and they would go, I thought this was vegan.
Yeah,
like you know, like it's incredible. Now I think we're spoiled and Daya is way less appealing, you know, now that you have like new like chow cheese is coming out and that stuff's pretty incredible. But they used to do a lot of Veg Fest, and I haven't seen them at a Veg Fest in a while, which is a bummer because I like getting my, you know, grilled cheese sample. But yeah, it seems like they're secure in their position in the market.
And even if vegans are starting to be like, oh, there are other cheeses that are just as good as Daya, it's like it seems like when a non-vegan restaurant has to use vegan cheese, that is the first thing that they always use. Again, especially like I'm just in Connecticut, so that's what I'm seeing here and in the Northeast, but it always seems like that is their go-to. And it's like, why would, I don't know. I'm furious about it.
Well, as a well-traveled person, I can say that it's the same everywhere. Daya is all over the place. And that's the one that's in the grocery stores. Like, you know, obviously before it was like the Galaxy shredded cheese that actually had whey in it or casein in it. And, but now it's like if there's a vegan cheese in the supermarket, it's going to be Daya. Yeah. So it's like they're pretty omnipresent in the vegan cheese world.
Yeah, and if anything, their marketing people should have you listening, Daya marketing people? They should have realized that by doing this, it probably turned off more people than it gained because, like, a lot of meat eaters are going to be like, oh, vegan, get away from me. So it's like, if anything, I feel like they probably lost some Daya users. I'm still going to use it after all this rant. I still use it occasionally.
But. Yeah, I mean, that said, it doesn't deter me from using Daya. They're, you know, not my number one brand, but they work in a pinch. We made pizza the other night that had some Daya on it, and it was really good. And
very nice.
And their cheesecakes are actually, I think, the best thing that they've done.
Yeah, they're
very
delicious.
Spot on, at least the regular. I had a bone to pick with the strawberry flavor. Not a fan of that strawberry flavor, but key lime is quite nice.
Is this another Unity scathing review?
Well, we got to dedicate a full hour to the horrible strawberry flavor of the Daya cheesecake.
I don't know if I've had it. I feel like I have, and I feel like I liked it. But
all right, so now that we have just totally ran the Daya well dry...
Yeah, I do want to say that I'm still going to use Daya, and I still think it's very good, and it is still something that I will make for non-vegans, and they will appreciate it as long as it's melted. But yeah. So sorry, Daya, you can sponsor us in the next episode. You're gonna hear this episode sponsored by Daya, the best cheese for vegans, for non-vegans, for everybody.
The only vegan cheese, Daya. All right, so I think we've run that well dry. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you out there. Do you think we're wrong? Do you think we're right? Especially if you think we're wrong. We like hearing those dissenting opinions and having that conversation. I guess one last thing I would add is that whenever I see a group post about, like, oh, what's your favorite? What do you want to be your vegan Ben & Jerry's flavor? And there's a flood of people. Like, why would you ever support this? And, of course, that's what spawned on the topic. But if you're like, I wouldn't give that because they torture cows. And it's like, well, your vegan dollar spent with them is not going to make them go, oh, we sold a vegan product, let's go make a non-vegan product. It's let's make another vegan product. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's supply and demand. That's how it works.
Also, I thought you were just going to say, oh, I see people on Facebook posting, what would your Ben & Jerry's vegan flavor be? And people saying, chocolate! And you saying, no, why aren't you making something more weird? I thought that's where you were going with that. But I guess you made a better opinion than what I thought you were going to say.
I mean, I will rail against someone that just wants chocolate peanut butter ice cream at this point. All right, I think that about wraps it up. We are going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to dive right into our interview with Tony Okamoto.
Hey everyone, this is Paul of The Bearded Vegans. Thanks so much for listening. I just wanted to let you know that The Bearded Vegans is part of the Commentist Network, and you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. And I would encourage you to learn more about the show at thecommentist.com. That's thecommentist.com. We also have a lot of other great shows on the Commentist Network. I do two other shows. One of them is called Continuous Improvement. That's just a kind of general positivity podcast. And then I do one with my brother and some of my other friends called Roll to Hit, which is a Dungeons and Dragons podcast. So yeah, please check all those out. Thanks for listening again, and let's get back to the show.
Tony Okamoto is the founder of Plant Based on a Budget. She spent 2 years at Animal Place before moving on to become the food and lifestyle coordinator for Vegan Outreach. Tony, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So I'd like to start off right at the top and just have you explain to our listeners what Plant Based on a Budget is.
Plant Based on a Budget is a resource that has inexpensive recipes that have ingredients you can easily find at conventional grocery stores. Everything should be found already in your pantry. We use basic ingredients like flour, sugar, cornmeal, and then beans, rice, quinoa, lentils, and vegetables. We have weekly meal plans. We have interesting articles.
Awesome. Yeah. And so how long ago did you start the website?
We started the website 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago in April.
Cool. Well, congratulations on the 4 years.
Thank you.
When you started it, you know, there's obviously tons of recipe blogs out there. So what was it that you felt like you could add to the vegan voice online that wasn't there already?
It wasn't really created for vegans. It was created for non-vegans. And I used my family as a model because they were just falling apart. They had all kinds of health issues. And anytime I would ask them about possibly changing something in their diets, they would say, oh, I can't afford your fancy food. And like, you spend too much money at Whole Foods. And so I took all of our family recipes and I made them vegan and I put them online. And that is why Plant Based on a Budget started. I just wanted my family to eat healthy and to see that it didn't need to break their bank. And then there was so much interest in those recipes from my friends and my friends' friends that I invited other contributors to participate. And that's how Plant Based on a Budget got started.
Awesome. And so you, I was going to ask, you know, what you thought your original audience was, and did that turn out to be, so you said you didn't make it for vegans specifically. Mm-hmm. Did that turn out to be the case? Did you basically get the audience you were expecting? Did it change over time?
We had a huge support system built in from the vegan community right away. I think the first week we did it, PCRM promoted it on Facebook, and we got 1,000 followers. So we had just from the first week, we had huge support from the vegan community. But I think now people who are on a budget come to plant-based on a budget because their friends told them that if they're on a fixed income or if they have very limited resources, this is a good option. And I constantly get emails and calls and all kinds of different things from people who are on, like, for example, in California, we have CalFresh, so it's like food stamps, and someone will message me and say, you know, I have three kids, and this is my income, and I found your weekly meal plans, and I'm so thankful because now we're able to eat healthy foods. And they're not vegan or interested in veganism, but because it's so inexpensive, the meal plans are around $25 per person per week. They use it, and they're eating a vegan, mostly vegan meal plan for their entire week or more.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's definitely, I think even just quickly looking through the website, everything looks delicious. It looks easy. It looks accessible. It's not weird foreign ingredients that you're only going to use like one time. So it's awesome that, you know, people are finding it, the people that need to find it. Yeah. Something else that I love about the website is that you also have a blog. It doesn't seem as active now. It seems like most of the posts are happening on Facebook, but I love that mixed in with, of course, all these great recipes and meal plans is articles and posts about other issues. Specifically, food accessibility is something you address a couple of times. And is that something you initially, you know, planned on addressing with the website, or was there, you know, information you came across that made you feel it was important to start talking about those issues?
It's not something that I definitely thought I wanted on the blog when I first started, but I've been interested in those issues in my personal life before the blog, and hearing from so many different people about how challenging it is to get healthy food in their areas or with their budgets, I felt it was something I needed to address, especially because I feel that sometimes the vegan community is not very sensitive. And I would post something on Facebook, and there would be tons of comments about how I'm not a vegan for promoting oil or sugar or salt or whatever, or BPA lined cans of beans, and so I was just becoming so frustrated that it was something that I wanted to talk about more. And I think having other people, like other voices, add to that, like Stickman and his wife Afia, they were able to do a better job reaching more people with these ideas. And I'm really thankful that they were able to contribute.
Yeah, and Stick wrote an article or a blog post, seven ways to eat good on a hood budget. Did I get that right? Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I imagine that probably brought in a lot of people to the website that were not already checking it out before.
Right. That was unreal to me because it was so easy to do. I sent him a message on Facebook, and I said, hey, I love Let's Get Free. It's my favorite hip-hop album. I started listening to it right when it came out. I was in middle school, and your words are so important to me and all of my ideas. Would you be interested in helping me promote veganism? And it was simple. He said yes. He wrote this beautiful article, which was way more elaborate than I originally thought it would be. And the first day we put it out, I think I put it out maybe around noon or 1. And by the end of the night, it had already had 100,000 views. So that's a lot.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I met him very briefly at the Atlanta Veg Fest, and he was just the most down-to-earth, like, coolest guy ever. And we use Be Healthy by Dead Prez for our little intro music on the podcast. So hoping, you know, we get him on at some point.
Imagine if you could send him a random Facebook message, he'll do it.
All right. I'll use you as a reference. But yeah. Okay. So bringing it back just a little bit, you mentioned receiving criticism from other vegans, and you actually made a post called Remembering Privilege addressing that specifically. And I won't ask you to rehash it because you basically just did, but that was written November 2013. Do you feel like vegan attitudes about these things have changed at all since then, or do you find yourself just running up against the same criticisms of your recipes and meal plans?
Oh, gosh. I get an email every day telling me that I'm not vegan enough. It's at this point, I'm not offended anymore at first, especially on plant-based on a budget stuff, because I did that stuff for free. I was investing so much of my time. All of my contributors were just dedicating so much of themselves to provide this resource. And then other people would be so mean about it. And I think in one of my meal plans, or maybe in all of my meal plans, I say, you know, I'm opening up my kitchen to you. I'm very vulnerable. This is what I'm eating. And I'm not saying that you need to eat this, but it works for me. And gosh, some people are so mean. I feel better about it now because more often than not, I'm receiving positive feedback, and that keeps me going. But with my work for vegan outreach, I do food-related stuff, and sometimes, like every day, I get, even yesterday, I got something saying how oil is terrible and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I certainly see that all the time when, you know, so for instance, there was, you know, 7-Eleven announced they were going to be switching all of their mayonnaise to Beyond, or just mayo, rather. And I posted it and someone responded saying, like, well, all oil is horrible for you. And I was like, I don't think anyone, you know, buying a sandwich from 7-Eleven is caring about the oil. Like, isn't it better that it's not eggs? Like,
absolutely.
But yeah, so all right, so let's move on to vegan outreach. So you became the food and lifestyle coordinator, and that's the title, correct?
Correct.
All right. Yeah. And so your first big project was putting together the cruelty-free eating guide.
Yes, the guide to cruelty-free eating. Yes. And it we had one already, but we consolidated it. We'd cut it in half. And so before, we would only pass it out to people who are already vegetarian, because it is geared more for vegetarians. It has information on egg and dairy industries. So because it was so expensive to make, we were a little bit more selective of who got it. But now, since we cut it in half, it's the same size as our other leaflets, and we're able to give it out more frequently.
Awesome. And so I was curious about the process of putting that together. And, you know, because so many people are like, well, this isn't vegan, that's not vegan. Like, you know, when someone's first going vegan or considering or even thinking about going vegetarian, it can be a really overwhelming thing. And it's like, you don't want to overload people with too much, and oh, you got to take these vitamins and do that and look out for this. And so, you know, when you were putting it together, was it solely up to you what was going in there? Was there a team? And how did you all, or just you, decide what should go in and what shouldn't go in?
It's a pretty extensive process. I did the first draft. I took the old guide, found what I liked, what I didn't like, and rewrote it. I typed everything out, and then once I was done with that, we formatted it, and I put pictures in the way I thought they should be placed, and then I brought it all to what was our guide committee, and we went over everything. We tried not to offend anyone. We tried to put in the best photos that are representative of veganism that would appeal to a lot of people, and we just tried to make everything, I guess, appeal to the most people. We wanted to make veganism inclusive.
Right on. Well, it's a beautiful guide. Your smiling face is on the cover, of course.
Thank you.
Very cool. Well, so you're obviously very entrenched in, you know, working for animals, and curious about rewinding a little bit and just, you know, was wondering, how did you get into all of this? Did you sort of go vegan and like, I need to go work for and help animals? Or was there like a long process? Like, how did you dive into this type of work?
It's been a long process. I started off right after high school, I became a vegetarian. But in high school, I was a runner, and I was getting really sick all the time from eating poorly and then exercising very intensely. And my coach said, how about you cut out red meat? And so I did, and my running improved. And after that, maybe like right after high school, I moved out of my family's house and I decided I wanted to become a vegetarian now that I was feeding myself. And I was still a vegetarian for health reasons, but I started learning more about the meat industry and decided I was an ethical vegetarian. And then at my community college, I learned more about how hens are treated and how cows are treated. And I was so sad, but I couldn't make the change. So at my community college's veg club, I met 10 of my best friends who I'm still really great friends with, and we all became vegan together. It was helpful for a lot of different reasons, but one, almost all of them were very deeply rooted in their cultural foods, and we had all decided that that was the reason we couldn't be vegan, because I love Mexican food, I love Chinese food, I love Vietnamese food, but when one of us was able to do it and still enjoy their cultural foods, all of us saw how easy it could be done. And so it was a great support system, and we started to do this weekly night dinner once a week called Womanly Wednesdays, and everyone was invited, but it started off as all women, and we made vegan food, and I checked out cookbooks from our local library, and that's how I learned how to cook.
Right on. And so how did you make the transition to, you know, working professionally in the field of, you know, you started at Animal Place, and how did you, is that something you stumbled upon? Did you apply? Were you like actively looking for a job? I often have people ask me like, how do I get a job getting paid to help animals? And it seems like it's sort of this holy grail for a lot of people. So how did you get into that?
I started plant-based on a budget. And it's funny because I think a lot of people talk about like slacktivism and in blogging and how blogging isn't a way to help animals. But for me, it was the introduction to helping animals. First, I started this blog and I invested all of myself into it. I was spending 15, 20 hours a week on creating meal plans and recipes. And from there, I developed social media skills that I was able to take to Animal Place when they were looking for a social media coordinator. And that's how I got my foot in the door. I had built a resume through plant-based on a budget work. It grew pretty quickly. Right now, we're somewhere around 4 million views. And that's how I got into Animal Place. Right on. And from there, I love it so much. Helping animals is the best.
Absolutely. So very cool. So it's cool to hear your journey. I'm always interested to see how people, you know, did it. Everyone, obviously, it's the most basic question, like, what's your vegan story? But yeah, it's always just interesting to hear people's different stories. So most recently, I saw a post about Tony's Tips. It's a weekly vegan tip thing. Could you explain what that is to everybody?
Right. So with Vegan Outreach, we give people on college campuses or concert goers all this information. We're like, here is all this information. And we want to make sure we set them up for success when they find out and they want to make a change. We want to make sure that they have the tools to succeed in a vegan lifestyle. So I created this 10-week plan that includes engaging videos of me making recipes or talking to them about veganism. And then I also had the president / co-founder of Vegan Outreach do nutrition tips. He's a registered dietitian who specializes in vegan nutrition. And I think that's really helpful too, because a lot of people are concerned about making sure they have all the nutrients. I think they're more concerned when they become vegan than they were ever when they were eating, I don't know, McDonald's or who knows?
Yeah, and so, you know, for people that are listening and maybe trying to reduce their food budget, like what, and still, you know, eat healthy, of course, what are your favorite tips that you like to give to people if someone's like, give me your top five tips or top three tips? What would you recommend people do for eating, you know, healthy on a low budget?
I'm so fortunate to live in California where produce is abundant. I love living here, but if you have access to a farmer's market, definitely go there. I go to our local farmer's market at the end, and it's very, very common at the end for people to either give away produce because they don't want to carry it back or sell boxes, like 20-pound boxes of fruit for $5. And I just freeze it. I cut it up. If it's going bad, I cut it up and freeze it and then use that for smoothies or during the summer for tomatoes, I boil them, freeze them, and then make tomato soup and freeze that. So going to your farmer's market is one of them if you have a farmer's market. Obviously, buying in bulk is a popular thing, but it's so important because it's significantly cheaper and it reduces waste in packaging. And then cooking when you're free, which I think a lot of people don't want to do, but on a weekend, if you have one day you can set aside, prepare a lot of your food then. You can throw it in a crock pot if you want to, or make a big pot of soup, but I found that I will eat a lot healthier after work during the week if I have already prepared it, because I'm so tired after work that I don't actually want to invest the time in cooking then, and I just won't eat, or I'll eat something really crappy. So if I've already done the work, I'll likely eat healthier throughout the week.
Very cool. And what's your absolute favorite meal to make in advance, to like make for the full week?
I really like soups and chilies, just because they're so easy. On plant-based on a budget, I have this recipe called four bean crock pot chili, and it's so easy. You just throw everything in a crock pot. It's got four beans. It's packed with protein, and I grated vegetables in there, so you can't really taste them, but they're there providing you nutrients. And that lasts all weekend. Sometimes if I'm feeling really fancy, I'll make cornbread to have for the week too.
Cornbread and chili, classic meal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. All right. Well, Tony, thank you very much for joining us today. This is a pleasure to have you. And of course, people can check out plantbasedonabudget.com and veganoutreach.org if they want to. Like, where can people find Tony's tips?
It's on the website on veganoutreach.org. In the sidebar, there's something that says Tony's weekly tips.
Awesome. Again, well, thank you so much for having us. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Andy.
So we hope you enjoyed that interview with Tony. One last thing before we go, though. We're trying to come up with a good signing off phrase, and we are not really having any luck. So we're sure that you can come up with something with a better slogan, such as the one that we came up with, Keep Calm and Beard On.
Which is probably already on a million terrible t-shirts and Spencer's gifts across the nation.
Yes. So please send in your catchphrase submissions to our email, which is thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Or you can always connect with us through our Instagram, which is @thebeardedvegans. So thanks again, everybody. For the animals, we are the Bearded Vegans. And don't forget, beard on, friends. Beard on.
You see what I'm working with here? All right, Bearded Vegans, signing off.
Only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school. My household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel.